Hello, 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 and welcome to the Boag World Show, where we discuss user experience, conversion optimization, digital leadership, and whatever else I feel like discussing in a particular week. My name is Paul Boag, and obviously I'm being joined by Marcus. Hello, Marcus.
My name is Marcus. Hello.
I'm sure we should take it in turns, to introduce the show.
And hi, I'm Marcus, and this is Paul. Yes, we should do that, but I feel completely unprepared as usual. But if you give me a bit of a run-in, I probably could do an intro maybe on episode 15, I'm thinking.
Something like that.
Maybe.
That sounds great.
I'm not sure.
So in today's show, we're going to be talking about my app of the week, which is going to be something called Microsoft Clarity, if you haven't heard about it. We're going to look at the subject of objection handling, and we're going to be looking at an article which talks about really how user experience design is being changed by AI. So that is pretty much the plan for this week.
Mm.
But before we get into all of that, we need to talk about how bloody hot it is.
It is, although
because
weirdly, in my house, it's not. I'm very lucky. I live in an old, really old house. Upstairs is boiling hot, but downstairs, fine. I could almost put my slippers on.
Does it get cold in the winter?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's the downside. I would take a house that's too hot than a house that's too cold.
In other news, though, Paul, I have used Claude.ai twice since we last spoke. Are you proud of me?
I am proud of you. And what did you think of it? Did you enjoy it?
I did it really well. I kind of knew what basically I took a couple of videos of meetings that I've been through. I put them into Descript to get the transcript.
Audio.
Mm-hmm. The transcript. And then plugged that into Claude AI and said, give me the action points. And it did.
Ooh, I can do better. Ooh. Do you want to even... This is an invaluable app, Marcus.
Okay.
And it's free. Well, the basic is I pay for it because it is so bloody brilliant. It's called Fathom. I need to put a link in the show.
I've heard of this before. Maybe you've mentioned it somewhere else.
I suspect you've seen it. At some point, we've had a meeting together.
Ah.
And it comes into the meeting.
Mm.
And it records the meeting. And then it gives you, at the end of it, a kind of AI summary, action points, questions that were asked. But for each of the things, it also gives you a link to that specific point in the video.
That's really good. I mean, Zoom, I think, does this now, but I just
it
not
does.
Turned it on.
It does, but not all of your meetings end up being in Zoom because, you know, a client invites you, or in my case, a client invites me into Teams or something like that.
Mm.
And also, it doesn't do as good a job at it because this is keeping a recording of it, is keeping a searchable transcript. You can even ask it questions and just have a chat with it about the meeting and that kind of thing. So I really, really recommend that you at least give Fathom a go for one meeting. I know you're a Luddite and don't like new things, but
that's just the role I play, Paul.
Good.
That's the role I play.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Keep saying that. So there you go. That's an extra app for free that we weren't going to talk about today, but it is really good. There are lots of other ones. There's Otter and there's, I can't remember them all, but Fathom is the one that I personally like.
Mm.
I don't really know why. I just got used to it. You know what it's like with these things. You get used to one and then you stick with it.
So back to it being hot, Paul. Sorry.
I was going to transition lovely into the app there, but I just got
bored of that stuff. So I thought, I need to ask you, are you drinking wine there? It looks like you are.
Well, I might be.
Yeah, but that's cool.
Is it too early to drink wine?
Absolutely not.
It's 3 in the afternoon.
It's 9:30 in the morning. That's normal, isn't it? And I'm editing this, so no one's going to know what you just said.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, you can just keep it at 9:30, can't you? Yeah,
I know. No, I'm slightly jealous. I think you've got a nice crisp white there by the looks of it, Paul.
Yeah, yes, it's my wife. I was very wound up before the show because I'm fighting with... what? It's my own fault, right? Here's the truth of it.
All right, okay.
I installed the beta... of iOS.
Well, you're an idiot, right? Aren't you? Come on. No one does that.
I know. I'm an idiot. And so it was fine, except for my banking app stopped working. And it's like, oh, so I was swearing a lot. And my wife decided, took mercy on you, really, yeah. Marcus.
Here's some wine, Paul.
Yeah, have some wine so that you don't swear your way through the show with Marcus. So there we go.
The golden rule is leave it till the point one. Not don't.
Oh, that's so dull. You've got to live life, Marcus.
No, all my music stuff stops working if I upgrade before point one. And just, or in your case, boring. Your banking app. Anyway.
I regret nothing. Well, yeah, I do regret everything. But I, on principle in life, I regret
quite right
nothing.
Too. I'll shut up now.
Go
Paul.
Where angels fear to tread and all that.
We wrote a song called...
Can I talk about an app
yes,
now?
Yes, go on.
Is that right? Right. So don't pull that face. Not that people can see your face. Have you used Microsoft Clarity? Is that one you're familiar with?
It's not, but what it does, I'm familiar with.
It's just
what was the one we used
brilliant.
To use? We used to get...
Hotjar.
No, before that.
No?
Oh. We used to get sponsored by it.
Crazy Egg, was it? No, Full Story.
That's it.
No?
Full Story. Full Story. Yes. So
I don't know if Full Story did all of the things that this does, but yeah, it was similar. It was a similar idea. So, but here's the thing. Sorry, Full Story, who previously sponsored yeah. us. Microsoft Clarity is free. You see,
I didn't realise that. Free Microsoft. They're going to sting you soon, though, aren't they?
It's been going for a hell of a long time.
Okay.
I think it's their answer to Microsoft Google. No, Microsoft Google? What's that?
I don't know. Google Analytics.
Oh, Google it. I've had half a glass of wine, and there you go. It's already going to pot. So I think it's their response to Google Analytics, that they wanted something equivalent in the marketplace,
okay.
and they've come up with Microsoft Clarity.
Well, anything can be better than the new Google Analytics. It's rubbish.
Oh, you're not kidding me.
So
I'm just longing for the day where they integrate AI into Google Analytics. You can just go in and say,
ask a question
in plain English. Yeah. This is what I want to know. Just tell me. You know?
Yeah.
Microsoft Clarity. Yes. So go to clarity.microsoft.com if this is of interest to you. But basically what it comes down to is a bit like Hotjar, if you've ever used that. So rather than kind of loads of analytics are a bit of a pain in the ass, it's much more designed for the likes of us, you know, where we, there's specific things we want to know. We want to know how people are using the app, that kind of thing, or website, whatever. So it gives you kind of four things that I really like. One is it will give you insights, right? So straight on the homepage, it will tell you things like how many people have done dead clicks. In other words, they've tried to click on something that's not clickable, right? An image, a piece of text or whatever, which is immediately obviously a thing that's useful to know. You know, oh, people are trying to click on that image because they think it'll take them through to the article.
Yep.
That kind of stuff.
That's good.
Then it records rage clicks, where people lose their shit and start repeatedly clicking aggressively on the page, which is another good thing to know. It also shows excessive scrolling. You know, when you get to that point on a web page where it's like, I can't find what I want, and you just kind of scroll up and down randomly looking for things. So it records that.
Okay.
It records quick backs, which are a bit like bounces, basically, where somebody goes to a page, then goes, no, that's not it, and goes back. So you know your labeling is wrong. It also records errors and shit like that. So all of those are really good insights to start tracking down where there's a problem. So I use Microsoft Clarity loads when I'm doing conversion rate optimization and I'm trying to improve a website post-launch. So that's really good. Then with any of those, you can create filters. So you can basically say, I want to know, see anybody who dead clicked or anybody who rage clicked or whatever. And then I can go in and I can look at heat maps to find out what it was that they were dead clicking on, or, you know, that kind of thing. So I can see nice heat maps. Great. But I can also watch sessions back. So I can watch the sessions of people doing all of those things, which is just bloody brilliant for kind of diagnosing problems. But I think the thing that I really like it about it, and this kind of goes back to Full Story back in the day, that one of the things that made Full Story so interesting is that it records the entire DOM, right? The document object model. So everything that's going on in the browser for the user is being recorded. Now, why does that matter? And Microsoft Clarity does the same. Well, it matters because it means that any element can be tracked historically. Again, this is a bit of a hard thing. Once you realize what this means, it really becomes invaluable. But in Google Analytics, let's say if I wanted to track a particular button, right? Oh, I'm worried that people aren't spotting that button. They're not clicking on it. They're not interacting with it. I'd have to go in and add an event handler to that button so that I can therefore track it. And then once I've added the event handler, I can only get future data on that button use. I don't get historical data. But because Clarity is recording everything that's going on, you can say, I want data on this button. And even though you've not attached an event to it, you can get all the historical data on that button you want, right? Which is obviously incredibly powerful. And it's all relatively easy to use as well. It's not quite so intimidating as Google. Well, it's nowhere near as intimidating as Google Analytics. So you can just go in and say, I want to filter. I want the last X amount of time. I want any time somebody clicks on this text, you just put the text to your button in and voila, you've got all the data that you want. So I really love this app. It's really cool.
That sounds really good, even to the point of I might actually even try using it. I've never been a fan of session recordings. I don't really get it. Watching people moving around, the mouse moving around the page, it's like, yeah, okay. But heat maps are fabulous because they show, you know, because the problem with session recordings is I'm only watching one at a time, which I'm not sure I think the value of that is that much. But heat maps are great. But basically, it being able to show you where people are struggling, fabulous. That sounds great.
So I have almost a kind of little order that I do things. So first of all, I want to know where on the site things are going to shit, right? Let's imagine I'm doing some conversion optimization, you know. Is the problem on the landing page? Is it on the product page? Is it on the shopping basket, etc.? So I just look at exit rates in Google Analytics to work that out, right? Where the problem pages are. Then I go and look at any Microsoft Clarity insights for that particular page, right? Are there a lot of rage kicks? Are there a lot of dead clicks, right? So I'm beginning to narrow in at what the problem is, right? I know the page. I know now the type of thing that the way people are responding on that page. Then I'll look at the heat maps. Where are they rage clicking? Where are they scrolling? Are they potentially missing stuff? And only then, if I'm still unsure of what's going on, do I then watch the session recordings to kind of dig in a bit deeper.
Sure.
If I'm still sat there going, I don't know, then I might run some usability testing, facilitated usability testing that goes through that page. So it's kind of an escalation path where it progressively becomes more work. If I'm really stuck on what the problem is. But most of the time, you get as far as heat maps and you kind of know what the problem is and you can fix it, you know?
Cool.
So, yeah, sounds totally good. Agree.
And a free product from Microsoft. Wow.
I know, which is amazing. How long it will remain free, who knows? But it has been for a few years now. This isn't a product that's appeared overnight. You know, it's been around for a little while. And, you know, Google closed down their free products every now and again. I still haven't forgiven them for closing down Google Optimize, which is their A/B testing platform. Bastards. Yep.
They don't care. Why did they change from Universal Analytics 3 to 4? I mean, and make it shit. It's like, why? I'm not sure there is the reason is money, but it's like, well, it's not obvious to me why.
I think it's because, in my opinion, Google Analytics has become, there was a stage where it was just focused on websites, but now they want to use it in apps and software and all kinds of shit. And so that naturally makes it more complicated.
Mm.
And I think they've redesigned it in an attempt to accommodate all these different use cases. And also, you know, the power users are asking for more and more features and ability to do stuff like that. So it ends up with this becoming this really powerful but really hard to use app.
But it's, I would argue that it's not as powerful. You don't have, it's got a little bit dumbed down. You can't get the controls that you used to be able to and set the filters. Well, and things.
You can. I ended up sitting down and doing their. They've got an online course that I sat through, wanting to pull my teeth out the whole way through. For GA4 in an attempt to kind of understand it. I don't think I got to the very end, to be honest. I think I gave up, but I got quite a way through it. And no, it's all in there, but it's all custom reports. Basically, you have to build custom reports for everything. Yeah. Well, before, you could get most of the stuff that you needed just by looking at the standard dashboards that they provide. Mm. Now, those are really, like you say, they've been really dumbed down.
Yeah, I have.
And so you have to build a custom report for everything, and it's a pain in the ass. But, you know, we're just old and grumpy, Marcus. That's what it is. I bet Chris loves it.
No, Chris hates it.
Oh, does he? Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah, he's of the same thinking that I am. It's like, well, why change it?
Let's talk about the subject that I want to talk about today. I thought it'd be nice to talk about objection handling a little bit, because this is something that I think is a really important part of most marketing type websites, you know, whether it's an e-commerce site, whether it's a services site, that kind of stuff. And it's an area that I spend quite a lot of time on. It's a bit of a random thing to pick. It's just something that interests me. So therefore you now have to listen to it. So it's the basic principle that when somebody comes to the moment of acting on a website, they have worries, right? There are things that stop them acting. And none of it is particularly rational. And it all goes back to kind of our lizard brain, really, that is constantly looking for danger in any situation. And because we've got no tigers to worry about these days, we worry about, you know, are they going to sell my email address? You know, that's the kind of level of threat that we're dealing with these days. And so at those moments of acting, our brain gets kind of flooded with all of these random thoughts about, you know, am I going to be able to cancel easily? Are they going to sell my email address? Are they going to, you know, do whatever else? There's all these different things depending on the different use cases. And so the idea of objection handling is to kind of nip those things in the bud, right? And so when people have those, where those kinds of feelings bubble to the surface, that you're there, ready to reassure them, ready to deal with them. So it's a kind of content issue. And most websites that people work on, if you're not responsible for the content is normally pretty shit. And so, you know, we have this obligation to kind of advise our clients that, you know, they often hire us to improve their conversion rate or make their website more successful. But if they put shit copy in it that doesn't deal with things like objections, then no amount of pretty design is going to overcome the fact that people are hesitant to act. So when I tend to work with my clients, and especially when I'm doing conversion rate optimization, where I'm looking to improve their conversion rate, I often, objection handling is a big part of it. So what I normally start off by doing is finding out what all those objections are, right? And depending on your time and your budget, that can be done in many different ways. Just exhibiting some basic empathy often helps, you know, of saying, well, okay, if I was buying this thing or I was, you know, I've been working recently on the agency academy that I've got running. And that's a great example of that, where it's like, okay, there's agencies and freelancers that are thinking of signing up to this thing. What would they be worried about? They'd be worried, you know, that maybe, here was a big one, that do I really want to sign up with this thing when all of these people in this group are going to be my competitors, right? They're going to be other agency owners. And so, you know, you have to address things like that. So a bit of empathy can get you partway there. But also a lot of the time I'll go and speak to customer facing staff. So if I'm working with an organization and they've got like a call center or they've got a sales team or something like that, then going and having chat with them is usually pretty good, because they deal with these objections all the time. So they know what they are, and they've often got really good responses to them as well, because they've been dealing with them for years, you know?
Talking to a sales team is not, it's great in this particular situation, but I've always said that they are top of the list after users to speak to if you can't get to the end user. Because they're the people that do actually speak to end users.
Yeah.
We work with a lot of law firms, and no matter how hard I've tried over the years, I've not ever spoken to one of their clients because they just won't let you.
Yeah.
And you can't, you know, we try and say, have you got any kind of like, you know, friendly clients who you can sort of test things out with? Yes. And then when it comes down to it, but not on this thing because it's not important enough for them or whatever.
So, yeah.
Basically, if you talk to their business development people, you get the answers secondhand, but you get the answers that you want.
And that's normally a pretty reliable source, to be fair, because, you know, they're facing these kinds of problems all the time. Exactly. So I totally get it. In other situations, sometimes I look at social media as well. I mean, it wouldn't work with law firms because they're not out there bitching about, you know, law companies necessarily. But if you're doing a B2C thing, then that can work, because people talk about their objections and why they didn't sign up for things and what their worries were and that kind of stuff.
I've talked about looking into social media as part of user research for years, and I've never done it. So I need to sort of, I'm slapping myself here to say, do that. Because I can even think I've sat in pitches and said, you know, we should be doing this, and then it doesn't happen. So it's good to see it noted here today, because it's a reminder.
Yeah, I mean, it is better for B2C than it is to B2B. But like you guys do, as do I, a lot of universities. Mm. And, you know, that's a great example of where you want to look at that kind of thing. And in their cases, especially these review sites, you know, where they do review my tutor and that kind of thing, or review my university, all kinds of bitching and moaning that goes on in there that you are objections, basically. Then obviously you can do direct engagement, like you talked about interviewing lawyers, but I do a lot of surveying as well. But even sometimes, as you say, surveying can be quite tough to get access to the right people. I do often use, there are some great recruitment tools out there now that will do a lot of this recruitment for you. So, for example, when I run surveys, I often use a tool called Pollfish, which will say, you know, I want these kinds of people. And you can even set screener questions. You could have a screener question like, you've hired a law firm in the last 12 months, for example. So I often run surveys through things like, it costs a little bit, it costs about $1 to $2 per survey response, but that's, you know, not terrible, is it, by any means? So, you know, that's worth doing. The other thing I will do a lot of when it comes to objections, and this is probably my favorite technique when I'm working on landing pages, is that I'll run an exit intent survey. So as people go to leave the landing page, and I think I do this on the Academy website, actually, I will say, oh, before you go, it would just be great to know why. Why didn't you buy today? Why didn't you act today? And because that helps me build up a picture of, well, how do I need to adapt and change? So gathering that kind of list of objections is really worthwhile, because it really shows you how to tailor the experience to better suit it. And one of the problems that you can get is that you get this list of objections back and you look through it and you think that they're unfair objections, right? And you're like, well, no, that shouldn't stop you. But it's really important to remember that it's not about whether it's fair or not. It's the perception, right? So a great example of this, of that actually is this podcast coming back, right? So, and I said this in episode one, that a lot of people with their mental model of the BOAG World Show is stuck in 2010. So they think, oh, that's not relevant to me anymore because, you know, I don't do what I did in 2010. But of course, we've moved on. But just because that objection isn't fair because we do, you know, talk about all the latest things, doesn't mean it doesn't need dealing with, because that's what people are thinking. So it's really important to remember that. So once I've got my list of objections, what I normally do is craft what I call objection handling statements, right? So to be clear, first of all, these aren't going to end up in an FAQ section because nobody ever bloody looks at FAQ sections. I hate FAQ sections with a passion. It's like, what is your website if it's not frequently asked questions? The whole website is your FAQs. You know, the idea of having a separate place to dump all this is lazy. Anyway, that said. So what I'm doing is writing short objection handling statements. So, for example, wondering about our quality, our products are backed with the 30-day satisfaction guarantee. Concerned about our shipping costs, orders over $50 are free. Worried about privacy, we never share your information without consent, right? Mm-hmm. And you could even drop the first part of each of those. You could just say, our products are backed by a 30-day satisfaction guarantee, or orders over $50 are shipped free, or we never share your information without consent. Right. So these little short sentences that you can then integrate alongside, you know, the kind of rest of your copy and your calls to action and that kind of stuff. And I know a lot of people worry about like planting these ideas in people's heads. Right. Oh, well, if I say worry about quality, you know, am I going to basically be setting myself up for people to think, oh, well, their quality is shoddy? And actually, bizarrely, McDonald's is a really good example of dealing with this, right? We've all heard the rumours about chicken nuggets and what's in chicken nuggets, right? But obviously, they don't want to draw attention to that. They don't want to say, don't worry, our chicken nuggets are not full of chicken testicles. Because, well, A, chickens are female, so they wouldn't have testicles. But B, they wouldn't want to say
it. The ones we eat aren't, though, Paul. they're generally male.
Yes, exactly. Very good point. So instead, what they do on their website is they say, they don't mention the rumours. They just make a really big point of saying all of our chicken nuggets are made with chicken breast, right? 100% chicken breast, it says on their website.
Moulded together, squashed together in a machine.
Oh, yeah, they're still disgusting. But, you know, don't get me wrong. But, you know, it's doing their part to address that kind of problem. So you can reframe these objections positively. So instead of saying something like worried about security, you can just say your bank is protected. Your data is protected by bank level encryption, right? Which, you know, doesn't kind of focus on the problem, but focuses on what would address the problem. And then, and this is the important bit, is you've got to integrate these statements into the website. And the most important bit here is timing, right? So you want to add these objections at the moment that they occur, which is why they can't just be in a FAQ section. So, for example, when I come to the payment form where I'm going to enter in my credit card details, that's the moment I care about security, right? So that's the moment where you need to say, you know, your data is protected by bank level encryption. Equally, when I'm entering my email address, that's the moment when you want to say, we never share your information without your consent, right? So it's really important to pick the right moments to kind of present this information right alongside those calls to action. So yeah, that's the kind of approach you use. I mean, obviously, as with everything, you should be gathering feedback, you should be testing, you should be refining these things. But that idea of find your audience's objections, write objection statements for each and integrate them into the site at the moment that people have those objections is a really good way to go. The reason that I chose objection handling as my topic for this week is because I have literally just written about it and I'm lazy and I reuse stuff, in a course that I'm running about landing pages in particular. It's a free email course that you can sign up for. If that sounds interesting and you want to learn more about how to create compelling landing pages, especially if you're a digital marketer or you work on those kinds of pages, then go to boag.world/landing and you can sign up for that for free. So there you go. That is objection handling. Does that meet with your approval, Marcus?
That's Paul's take on objection handling. No, I agree with all of that. I made him smile. It's brilliant.
What does that mean? I feel like something bad is coming now.
No, not at all. The only thing I would add to that, I mean, I think that going back to the first thing you were saying is this is a copy thing. It's about content and copy, and that needs to be very much part of the design job that we're doing. We like to do it in tandem with the client or a copywriter or whatever, but this is about writing good copy. You know, trying to get somebody to sign up for something or trying to get somebody to buy something, then yes, this has to be a part of it. The only thing I would say is that, and this is me, but I think I'm not alone, is I'm very wary of being coerced by websites. So if I'm being sold at, or we know people have this objection, so we're going to deal with it and make you feel happy, then I'm instantly going to kind of like go, ooh, I'm not sure about this. So you've got to be careful with the wording. That's all I'm saying. And I like it when the example you used earlier, when you said you could just do, sorry, I'm finding the notes, you could do sort of just the second half. So rather than saying, wondering about our quality, our products are backed by a 30-day satisfaction guarantee. Just saying our products are backed by a 30-day satisfaction guarantee, in my opinion, is all you need.
Now, that's really interesting, mine, because I think that's partly a cultural thing, Marcus.
Maybe.
Because I work with a lot of US clients at the moment, especially large US charity clients, and they are much more in your face with this kind of thing. And they say it a lot more explicitly than I would ever feel comfortable with writing myself. And it seems to work all right for them. So, but I do understand what you mean. I think you do need to be very careful about
it. And maybe in another country or whatever, where they're even more kind of in your face than the Americans. I guess what we're saying here is you need to bear in mind the cultural aspects of the audience. That's it.
And that in itself is a whole conversation to be had about, you know, that localization isn't just translation. It's a hell of a lot more than that.
Absolutely. You know? This site is worldwide, so we need to be careful about the imagery we use. It is more than that, even. It's about sort of... Yeah, I'm old and cynical, so I'm always looking. Somebody's trying to kind of, you know, are you trying to twist my arm here? I don't want that. It's up to me whether I buy this or not. So that's really
interesting, because you know, a lot of the kind of incentives that you would use. I mean, great example. Sorry, I've been talking about my academy a lot at the moment because the agency academy, because it's front and center in my mind. And you know, I decided to offer an early bird discount where it's £19 rather than the £28 per month at the moment. By the time this goes out, by the way, you've missed the early bird. Jeez. I did that. My motivation for doing that was because I knew I was going to be a bit ropey to begin with until I found my feet and got going. And I felt that, you know, I shouldn't charge the people that originally sign up full price. But now I've just sent an email out saying, just to let you know that the early bird is coming to an end. And there are some people that have taken that as, oh, you're pressuring me into buying. And so this goes back to the thing about perception. It's not what your intentions were or even what the reality is. It's how people see it that's the problem. So I came across a good article this week that I wanted to mention. It's about the role of user AI in user experience design. You can read it for yourself at boag.world/003, which is the episode number -1. And it was actually a really good read. And it's a subject I've been thinking about a lot recently, about how the user experience is going to change with AI over the coming years. And this certainly sparked some thoughts in me, because I think there's a tendency, and I think that I'm one of those people that have fallen into this trap, to kind of think about really the future of AI, because we're so familiar with these large language models now, like ChatGPT, Claude, and that kind of stuff, that we think about the user interface as being that chatbot user interface. And so that kind of skews maybe the way that we see it. And so this article, and also a conversation I had with one of the people that I coach, really kind of made me realize that it can be so much more than that. You know, so you could do things like, you could have much more, you could have dynamic navigation, for example, where, you know, as you drill down through, say, products in categories, that those categories could start to be generated dynamically based on the things that people were looking at, or even that you could learn maybe a bit about people's mental models, depending, you know, if it's an app, for example, where people are using it regularly, and you can structure stuff around that. And certainly with search, you know, you could see how on site search, how AI could be much, much more powerful. But then there were things like personalized experience. So, for example, if somebody had been referred from a particular site, let's say, for example, you go and check out, I don't know, the Agency Academy that I've mentioned here, and you've come because of the podcast and you followed a link from the podcast. Ah, well, that could enable me to dynamically alter the content to reference the podcast and be back, you know, based on that. And then there's things like intelligent A/B testing, where instead of me setting every variation that we're going to test, we just let AI loose to see, you know, and let it test lots of different variations. Then, of course, there's the opportunity for using AI with things like accessibility, which we're already beginning to see, where things like, for example, alt attributes on imagery is being dynamically generated rather than being generated manually every time.
That's one job that AI would do better than humans.
Yeah, exactly. Because they won't keyword stuff it for a start for social media purposes. But anyway, I mean, even we had that conversation, didn't we, when we were talking about this podcast and bringing it back, about whether we needed to produce transcripts or not. And the kind of conclusion we came to, well, there isn't a lot of point in some ways, because now you can get these transcripts that are automatically generated in whatever tool you fancy using. So, you know, there's that. And then there's that we could even do things like behavior-based security, where now instead of having to do bloody annoying capture forms and that kind of shit, we can just look at how people are behaving on a website in order to judge whether or not they're a real person. Forms are another great one, right? Where you could dynamically update forms based on people's previous answers or, you know, what they're doing. There's so many possibilities for AI, and I don't think we've even scratched the surface of it yet. And I think we're being quite narrow-minded in the way that we're looking at it. And okay, a lot of this stuff is maybe a bit kind of crystal ball gazing at the future, but I did think it was an interesting article that kind of grabbed my attention and made me think, all right, perhaps I'm looking at AI a little bit narrower than I should be. So yeah, I thought it was a good one.
I didn't.
Oh right, you didn't.
Well,
like the article.
That's not true, but I found it took me a long time to get to anything more than I'm just going buzzword, and
yeah,
things could happen in the future. Okay. But then near the end of the article, there was an example that I thought, okay, now we're talking. It was an example of, I can't remember the exact details, but it was a wood exporter from Africa, but that sent wood to the States, let's say, something like that. And they were talking about the idea of the software basically pulling in market data and weather data and possibly something else as well that could be fed into the stock requirements. And I'm like, well, now that is fantastic. Uh-huh. But I mean, a person could do that. But then I suppose, you know, it's they might not do it as well. They might not be able to see the meteorological model that AI could deal with. And I'm like, okay, yeah, that's a really good example. I was waiting for the example and thinking it's not going to be one, and then there was a really good one. So it's all right, fair enough. It just took too long.
But yeah,
to get there.
I do know what you mean. It was a little bit that way inclined. Yeah. I think it was more, instead of the article itself, it's what it sparked in me, if that makes sense. Yeah. So the very last thing I want to do before we endure your joke is I do want
enjoy
to
or endure
whatever you would prefer to hear there, Marcus. Okay. That's I'll leave that with you. One of the things I want to encourage is people to send in questions. And you can drop me an email anytime with a question at paul@boagworld.com, and we'll try to include it on the show. But obviously, what people don't know is we haven't yet launched the show. We're pre-recording these. So I've been looking elsewhere. So in the Agency Academy, Paul Edwards asked a good question that I thought might be worth answering, which is, what are the most useful content assets for gaining and generating new business as an agency, right? If you were starting again, what assets would you create first? What about you, Marcus? Because I'm quite interested in your perspectives. It will be very different to mine, I'm sure.
I wasn't absolutely sure what he meant, but I thought he might, you know, your website, that sort of thing. I would say that the most valuable content that we have created to gain business over the years have been our proposals.
Yeah.
So, I'll go off on a tangent on that. So yes, that would be the answer to basically start writing really good proposals so that we've got that content that you can kind of keep pulling back into newer proposals and reshaping. So that would be my answer. But I have never, I've talked about it many times, I've never kind of formalized it and categorized the content. It's just all in here somewhere. And that one I did 5 years ago. Well, that would work, you know. But last week we had our first employee ownership trust board meeting.
Oh yeah, how did it go? Was it good?
Yeah, really good. We talked about all sorts of things, but one of the things that we need to consider is mine and Chris's succession. So, you know, we're not going to be around forever. That's the whole point of, well, not the whole point, one of the main points. There were two points of doing it, and one of them was so that Headscape can carry on without us. We need to ensure that we've got our house in order. And we started doing it with other documentation policies, all that kind of thing, the grown-up stuff. But that question made me think, okay, yes. Mm. So I'm saying that our proposal documents are the most valuable content that we've created in gaining new work. But it's all a bit of a mishmash at the moment. So, yes, it was a bit of a slap around the face, really.
I know, it's depressing, isn't it? I think it's different for me because I don't do invitations to tender like you guys do. Mm. Because it's just me. It's, you know, it doesn't tend to end well with me. And I also, to be frank, I don't think I write as good proposals as you do, is the other aspect of it. So for me, I think it's really my email list is my number one most valuable asset. Mm-hmm. I've spent years building it up, but actually I probably only realized about 5 years ago it's probably something I needed, because mm-hmm. before that it was all social media and Twitter and that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And then Twitter kind of started imploding and I suddenly thought, shit, you know, if people aren't using this, how am I going to reach my audience? Mm. So that's where I started the newsletter, boagworld.com/subscribe.
Delete.
Yeah. So that that became really quite an important asset to me in terms of keeping in contact with prospective clients. And I guess what goes hand in hand with that is the landing pages that get people onto the mailing list. And I've got dozens and dozens of those in various forms for various things. Mm. And so, yeah, for me, it's that. So I'm, and I think that's very much probably the difference between you and me, that you're more of a salesman and I'm more of a marketing person in that regard.
Absolutely.
So we place the emphasis in different places. Yeah. Interesting. Anyway, if you are curious about the Agency Academy, as I seem to keep mentioning it, you can go check it out for yourself if you are an agency owner or a freelancer at boag.world/academy. Might be useful to you. Also, if you're interested in the show notes to get the articles we've talked about or the apps that we've discussed, then you can find out about those by going to boag.world/003. But I guess we end with Marcus's joke. I hope it. The last couple have been a bit too good, Marcus. You need to do worse.
So you've got to have things come in threes, so I think this is a good one. You may not.
Oh, right.
This is from Daryl Snow, who of the old show, probably.
Oh, really? He's still giving you jokes?
Well, he's on the Slack channel, and right? he pops up every now and then with a joke. I like his sense of humour.
Yes.
Most of them I probably couldn't use. But this one I can. So here we go. What do you call an apology sent by Morse code?
What do you call an apology sent by Morse code?
Remorse code.
That's quite bad. I think that's quite bad. I don't think
you
managed.
Oh, come on. Remorse. Yeah. That's pretty good.
I know. Yeah, it's clever and all that, but not that funny.
All right, then. Fair.
No.
That was rubbish, Daryl. Try harder.
Oh, I love the way that you immediately shifted the
receipt. Nothing to do with me.
It was the way it was delivered, I think, was the problem, Marcus, in my opinion. I think the joke could have been excellent in the right hands.
Yeah, okay.
All right. Thank you very much, guys, for joining us on this show. I hope you found it useful and entertaining. We'd love to hear from you. Drop us, either of us, an email. Me at paul@boagworld.com, marcus@headscape.co.uk. Anytime, about anything, we'd just like to know that you exist, really. So, yeah, drop us an email. Otherwise, we shall talk to you again next time.